Mark, in his gospel, one of the big things he wants to do is reveal that Jesus Christ, the Messiah, is the Son of God. That's what he wants to do. Look at verse 1, the beginning of the gospel about Jesus Christ, the Son of God. That's what he wants to put into our hearts and our minds. This is no ordinary man I'm talking about, he's saying, right at the beginning of his book. And we see that, don't we? We see it in the story today. This is no ordinary chap who's asleep on the pillow in the boat, is it? It's an incredible story. We've seen Jesus casting out demons. We've seen incredible miracles. But now we see something on a much, much vaster scale. It's enormous what he's able to do. What a story. What an incident. It's incredible. We take it for granted so often. We've heard the story, perhaps most of us, many times. But when we stop and think about it, what an extraordinary incident happened that evening in the boat. Verse 35. The day when evening came, he said to his disciples, "Let's go over to the other side." Oh, that's an ordinary beginning. If you remember from verse 1 of chapter 4, again, Jesus began to preach by the lake. The crowd that gathered round him was so large, was pushing in on him. In order to stop the crowd trampling him, he gets into a boat, pushes off from the shore a little bit, and he speaks. The crowd wants to get to him, so excited about the preaching. They want to touch him. Those who want healing want to get close. They're pressing in on him. So he gets in the boat, makes a little bit of space so he's not trampled. And as the crowd fills up the hillside in front of him, the water, his voice bounces off the water. It's like a little amphitheater, and his voice is projected, and everyone's hanging on every word he speaks. And we see his teaching through chapter 4, and we've considered them over the past weeks. And of course, this is just excerpts of what he said during the day. He would have been preaching for hours, and of course, he'd been preaching for day after day. He's tired. He's got to the end of the day, he's tired, and he says, "Come on, it's time to go." How is he going to get through the crowd? It's an enormous crowd. The easiest thing is just to push off from the shore and let the boat go. "Come on," he says, "let's go to the other side." Perhaps he wants to preach and continue his preaching on the other side. Perhaps he's just looking for a rest. He's certainly looking for a little bit of a break on the boat, isn't he? He's tired, and he wants to maybe take a break. They're on a body of water known as the Sea of Galilee. It's not really a sea. It's a freshwater lake. It's the second lowest lake in the world, the lowest being the Dead Sea, but it's the lowest freshwater lake, 686 feet below sea level. Because of the particular conditions of the lake, it's perfect for fish to breed in, and so it's a centre for the fishing industry. They have these smallish boats, open boats that go on the lake, and they catch enormous quantities of fish, and they actually export it right across the Roman Empire. It's a region known, famous for the fish, hence many of the disciples themselves are fishermen and have their own boats. Perhaps he was in one of the boats that belonged to one of the 12 disciples. It's a large lake. It's about 13 miles long by 8 miles, and it sits in a kind of a bowl or a basin with large high mountains on the east and lower hills to the west. It's close to the Mediterranean, and it has a particular climate there. And so he says, "Let's go across to the other side of the lake." Can you imagine the sunset? You know, there's a little bit of breeze. Luke says, as they sailed, he fell asleep. So there's a bit of a breeze. They don't even have to row. So it's a beautiful scene. The sails are up. Sunset, probably, maybe. I'm making that bit up on the lake. What could be better? We can relax, they're all thinking. And Jesus falls into a deep sleep. And we see, don't we, his humanity. He was just a man. Well, he was a man, not just a man. And he was tired, and he slept. He felt he's exhausted, and he falls into this deep sleep. And then, of course, verse 37, a furious squall comes up. and the waves broke over the boat so that it nearly swamped. Because of its unique location and the geography, apparently, I'm not an expert, I looked it up this week, the winds come in through the low hills to the west and they create just enormous storms suddenly out of nothing, because it's this bowl beneath the mountains. These incredible storms come up and you can get waves of between 5 and 10 feet, which are very big for a lake that size. And apparently that they crash against the side of the lake, then rebound off. And so you have this, it's turmoil. It's like a cauldron of, boiling cauldron of waves on the lake. And it's incredibly dangerous. If you've got these smallish open boats, the waves can come over, and it is extremely dangerous. And it's a known thing that happens on the Sea of Galilee. So it wasn't a total surprise, but perhaps it did take them by surprise on this peaceful evening. Without warning, it says in Matthew tells the story too, without warning, a furious storm came on the lake and the waves swept over the boat, but Jesus was sleeping. In spite of the storm, he's still sleeping there, probably on a raised platform at the back of the boat, so he's not lying in the water, and he's got his head on a pillow in this deep sleep. And his disciples then, they start to panic. They can just see that they're about to drown. Everything's out of control. There's experienced fishermen, experienced sailors though they are. There's nothing they can do. And they say to him, they come up and say to him, he's sleeping on the, and they said to him, they woke him and said to him, "Teacher, don't you care if we drown?" I think when they say, it says they said to him, perhaps that's a polite way of putting it. I think they were probably feeling it was a fairly urgent situation. I think there was desperation in their attitude and their voices. They were bewildered. Doesn't he care about the situation? How can he just be sleeping through all of this? What's going on? We thought we were going to change with this Jesus. The history of the world was going to be changed. The nation was going to be turned upside down. And here we are. Here we are. We're about to die, and he's asleep. He's asleep. And so they wake him up. Most probably they're looking for divine help. They know he's close to God. They know he's a godly person. And they think perhaps, well, he'll intervene. He'll intervene on our behalf, and perhaps God will help us. They come to him in desperation and confusion with a simple, a humble, and a rather weak faith. And in verse 39 it says, he got up, he rebuked the wind, and he said to the waves, "Quiet, be still." And immediately the wind dies down, the waves immediately calm, and the lake, it's like a pond in your back garden. You know, again, you can see the sun reflected in the surface. Immediately, what an incredible event. You know, at his word, He doesn't break sweat. There's no theatrics. He just stands and rebukes and commands the elements. He is in total control of creation. At his voice, the wind and the waves stop. There's something supernatural, overwhelmingly powerful in his command, and he calms this terrifying storm. He says to his disciples in verse 40, "Why are you so afraid? Do you?" He's rebuked the wind and the waves. Now he's gently rebuking his disciples. "Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith?" It's a natural thing to be a bit nervous in a storm like that. But he's saying, well, surely you've seen what I've been doing. You've seen my miracles. You've seen who I am. Surely you've learned something. Why are you so afraid in these circumstances? Haven't I proved myself to you already? Can't you trust me to take you where I've said I'll take you? I said we're going to the other side of the lake. Can't you trust me to do that?" And what was their reaction? Well, instead of being terrified of the wind and the waves, verse 41, now they're terrified of him. They were terrified and asked each other, "Who is this? Even the wind, even the waves." They obey him. The disciples, they're awestruck. And it's a rhetorical question. They knew. They knew what it pointed to. You couldn't see what had just happened without realizing someone very, very special is here. And they know their scriptures too. These men, they're soaked in the Old Testament scriptures. Psalm 65 says, it describes God as one who stills the roaring seas, the roaring of the waves. Psalm 89, the psalmist says to God, you rule the raging sea with its wave. When its waves rise, you still them. Psalm 93, mightier than the thunders of many waters, mightier than the waves of the sea, the Lord on high is mighty. Psalm 107, he made the storm be still, and the waves of the sea were hushed. No wonder one fear is replaced by another. They know they're in the presence of God. It's like, do you remember when Peter was called in Luke? It tells the story of when Jesus called Peter to be his disciple. He's out. He was preaching from the boat. And when he finished, he says to Peter, push your boat out and let down your nets. And he hauled and he said, wow, we've been working all night. Why would I do that? I'll do it because you say so, Master. And he does it and he pulls in this net of fish with his helpers and it almost breaks the net. The miraculous catch of fish. Who could have sent the fish into the net but God alone? And what's his reaction? What does Peter say? It's similar to what we see here. Peter says to him, go away from me, Lord, for I am a sinful man. Why would he want him to go away? Because he knows he's in the presence of God, a holy God. And his own sinfulness is revealed. His own weakness is revealed. He feels utterly pathetic in the presence of God. That's what being close to God does. It reveals. It reveals our weakness. It reveals our sin. And we see it in the Old Testament, Isaiah. So Isaiah says, woe is me, I am ruined, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips, and my eyes have seen the King, the Lord Almighty. I'm ruined, he says. Woe is me. It's a similar reaction. It's the same with Ezekiel. When I saw the likeness of the glory of God, I fell face down. It's the same with Daniel. Gazing at this great vision, I had no strength left. My face turned deathly pale, and I was helpless. That's how the disciples feel. Why is that? They're in the presence of God, not some faith healer, some miracle worker. They're in the presence of Almighty God, who made the heavens and the earth and commands the elements just by speaking. The fear of God came on them. They were in the presence of God. And they're really beginning to understand. It takes a while for the penny to... I mean, God in the boat with you? I mean, we think they're a bit dense sometimes, but, you know, it would take us time, wouldn't it? It would take time for the penny to drop. Later on, after this incident, if we look at it in Mark 6, similar situation. They're on the boat, crossing the lake, going into a headwind, they're pulling on the oars. It's very choppy, not quite as stormy, but it's very choppy. The wind's blowing hard again. And this time, they'd left Jesus behind, and he walks across the water on the lake. That's enough to make anyone afraid. And they are afraid because they think they've seen a ghost. But then, a few things happen with Peter, but then he gets into the boat, and again the storm stops. So they realize it's not a ghost. There's something much, much bigger, more scary than a ghost. And again, in that situation, the fear of God came on them. And it says in Matthew, this time they get a bit closer to understanding. They take a step forward in their understanding. Then those who were in the boat, it says in Matthew 14, worshipped him. You only worship God, don't you? They worshipped him and said, truly, you are the Son of God. This is what Mark wants us to understand from this story. This is what we need to understand, and this is what was dawning step by step on the apostles. What was it they needed to learn from God in these events, these God-ordained events? They must have been profoundly humbled on that day. They were made so aware of their weakness. For once, Jesus had given them a task they could do. Take him in the boat. That was their thing. You know, they sailed boats and rowed boats for a living. We'll take a cross. And suddenly, they're made aware that they were totally powerless, totally weak, totally unable to do anything, and they were thrown utterly and totally on the mercy of God. They had to turn to him. If they didn't turn to him, they would have been utterly lost. They would have lost their lives. They had nothing to look forward to apart from their own destruction. They were thrown on the mercy of God. What was it they needed to learn from this passage? Who was Jesus, the Messiah? Yes, he's the Son of God. He's God made man. That's what they were learning. And they also were learning. They were also learning. He was their protector. That he has sympathy, he has compassion, and he cares for his own. They needed to grow in their faith. They needed to understand completely that he was their protector. And he will do what he says he will do. He will get them to their destination. He has the power and the authority and the compassion to get them to the destination he has promised them. He's utterly trustworthy. They need to learn that he is God. He is powerful. And he's their protector. He cares. That's what they learn from this story. They learn these things. They took them on board. Peter was able to say, when he wrote a letter many years later, humble yourselves. He was humble that day. Humble yourselves, therefore, under God's mighty hand. Well, he was humbled and he saw God's mighty hand that day. Humble yourselves under God's mighty hand that he may lift you up in due time. Cast all your anxiety on him because he cares for you. And they saw that too, God's care for them in that situation. This is what they learned that day, and that's what we need to learn from the events of that day. Christians, they only die when their time has come. They only die in God's good timing. He will be with us every step of the way in our lives. We have no reason to doubt that whatsoever. And then one day, he will take us home to glory. And we have no reason to doubt that. No reason to fear. Oh, it's hard, isn't it? It's hard when you look at the waves and the wind. It's hard to keep that in mind. But that's what we need to learn from this story today. He is God. He cares for us. We can cast our anxiety on him. He's with us every step of the way, right up to that moment when he takes us into glory. And there'll be no storms then. We will be with him forever. Cast our anxieties on him. Our faith can be like that of the disciples, though, can't it? It's great in the sunset, sailing across the lake with no waves. It's wonderful. Then the storm comes and suddenly our faith goes wobbly. He wants us to grow in our faith. And we need to do that by considering this passage. How do we do that? It's easy to say, isn't it? Grow faith. How do you actually do it? Well, the first thing to remember is we should always remember there is no promise that bad things won't happen to us. They set off. They're following Jesus. Why would they have a why would a storm come along? That's what confuses them. They're being obedient. They're following Jesus, and a storm comes. But there is no promise that we will have a trouble-free life. Come and follow me, says Jesus. Well, did Jesus have a trouble-free life? Why would we expect to? If he didn't, would we expect to do so? He told us very plainly, if anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. That's not a promise of an easy life, is it? It's a promise of glory to come, but it's not a promise of an easy life. Don't you care, Lord, they said. Does that sound familiar? Would we ever feel like that? Creeps across our minds sometimes. Even if we don't say it consciously, it's there subconsciously sometimes, isn't it? Don't you care? Why are you sleeping, Lord? Don't you see what's going on in my life? The psalmist said it in Psalm 44, "Awake, Lord, why do you sleep? Rouse yourself." And the disciples in the boat could have quoted that psalm to him, couldn't they? "Don't reject us. Why do you hide your face and forget our misery and oppression?" We feel like that sometimes, don't we? When we get on our knees and we say, "Lord, don't you understand what I'm going through?" And he does. He's been through it. And he says, "I want you to learn." Facing trials and tribulations, it's part of God's plan for our lives so that we can learn. These disciples, they had to learn through this storm. We need to learn when we face our own storms. Sometimes it's the only way God can get our attention and make us pay attention. He allows these things into our lives. He wants to humble us so that we realize we shouldn't be relying on our own strength. We need to be turning to him and calling out to him. He stretches our faith, and he allows these things because he wants his glory to be revealed in the life of his disciples when they stand firm, even in circumstances they can't understand. People see the glory of God and through that situation. Dear friends, do not be surprised at the painful... This is Peter speaking later in 1 Peter. Don't be surprised at the painful trial you are suffering, as though something strange were happening to you. It's part of the Christian life. Don't be surprised. It's going to happen. That's one of the defences we have against our faith giving way. We know he will allow these things, and we know he's with us. Don't be surprised. Don't allow these things to undermine our faith. They're happening for a reason. So there's no promise that bad things won't happen to us. There's no promise there. But there is a promise that he's with us every step of the way. He's always with us. He will never let us down. We need to focus on those promises. We need to keep them in mind. We don't look at the wind and the waves. We focus on those promises. We know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him. That's what we need to focus on. Remember, he said to the disciples at the end of Matthew, "And surely I am with you always to the very end of the age. I will never leave you and forsake you," he said to Joshua. And he says it to us, to all those who are seeking to do his will. He is accomplishing his work in us and through us, even if we can't see it at the time, even if we don't see the reason in our lifetimes. He's working through the storms and the difficulties, and he's there with us. He's promised to be with us every step of the way, just like he was with the disciples in the boat. Sometimes it looks like he's sleeping, but he's not. He will intervene at the right time, at the right moment. He will calm the storm when it is right to do so. There is a promise that he's with us every step of the way, and there is a promise that he will take us through to eternity with him at the right time. We have those promises. Nothing could be more important than that. Nothing could be more wonderful than that. And that's what we focus on when the storm comes. He will get us through to the other side. Jesus said, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live even though he dies, and whoever lives and believes in me will never die." He's with us. He's with us every step of the way. It's absolutely certain he'll get us through to the destination. He wants us to have more faith. He wants us to remember who Jesus is. He's the Son of God. He wants us to remember his power, his faithfulness, and his compassion. Remember, he's with us even when it seems like he's sleeping. Don't be surprised when the storm comes. There's reason for them. And the storm will only last for as long as he intends it to last. He can, and he does, keep his promises. Well, today it's Palm Sunday. I don't think we've mentioned that yet, so I thought I should. It's 1 week before Easter. Traditionally, the church marks the triumphal entry of Jesus into Jerusalem. He's riding on a donkey, the foal of a donkey. And he's riding right into the viper's nest, isn't he? All of his enemies are there in Jerusalem. But let's be clear. Jesus was not a helpless victim. This is the Son of God. We've seen his power. Today in this story, we've seen the power that he could demonstrate any time he likes. This is God on earth. And here he is riding on a donkey into Jerusalem. The crowds are going mad. They're all incredibly excited. Perhaps this is the moment. Perhaps this is the moment the king is coming with us finally. And we see the story in Mark 11. It sets out the triumphal entry from verse 1 of 11. And verse 8 it says, many people spread their cloaks on the road while others spread branches they had cut in the fields. Those who went ahead and those who followed shouted, Hosanna! Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Blessed is the coming kingdom of our father David. Hosanna in the highest. So they think, here is this great preacher, this miracle worker who stirred up crowds. This is the moment they've been waiting for all this time. And by riding on this donkey, this colt, he's identifying himself with the old prophecy, the ancient prophecy of Zechariah. Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion, it says in Zechariah 9. Shout, daughter of Jerusalem. See, your king comes to you, righteous and having salvation, gentle and riding on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey. He's making it clear. By riding into Jerusalem like that, on this donkey, he's making it clear he was the Messiah. It's a clear statement to everyone. It's partly why the crowds are getting so excited. It's a famous prophecy, and here he is. He's fulfilling it. And yet he came to fulfill it in a way that no one expected. He could have, within a few days he was crucified, he could have stirred up the crowd. There was no question of it. There was the crowd going wild. He wouldn't have had too much to get to create some kind of uprising. And with that power he had, he could have created havoc in Jerusalem. He could have started a revolution. He could have had a kingdom and much more if he'd wanted to. He could have commanded armies. He could have commanded legions of angels. All of that was available to him. We've seen he demonstrated that power in the storm out on the lake. He could have done all of that, and yet he chose not to. The Son of God, he chose a different path. He chose obedience to his Father. Jesus Christ, who being, Philippians 2, who being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, but he made himself nothing, taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to death, even death on a cross. This is the extraordinary thing that Mark wants to reveal in his gospel. Jesus Christ, the Messiah, the Son of God, God himself, humbles himself, takes on the sin of the world, marches or rides into Jerusalem, and allows himself to be crucified. This was no accident. He didn't have to do it. He chose obedience for our sakes. Why? Because we were like those disciples in the boat, utterly helpless, unable to help ourselves in any way whatsoever, dead in our transgressions and sins. There's nothing we can do to save ourselves, other than throw, like the disciples did that day, other than throw themselves on the mercy of the Lord Jesus Christ. That's why he rode into Jerusalem. That's why he laid aside his majesty to rescue lost souls like us. That's what Easter is about. We see his power. We see how much he gave up. As helpless sinners, we need to turn to him. We're facing destruction like the disciples, and because Jesus cares so much for us, he gives his life for our sin. For us who are utterly lost without him. We need to admit our helplessness, our inability, and turn to him and ask him to save us. When we've done this, remember the storms of life will come, but he will bring us through them all. He's with us in them all, and he will bring us safely home.